This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. In the news, we look at a push out of FAA reauthorization, a court ruling on airline seat size, a NASA supersonic demonstrator, a couple of aircraft carriers, a United Airlines tale of woe, and a new Cirrus training program for old Cirruses. Is that the plural? Also, an Aviation Geek Fest announcement, Teslas and U2s, EAA Founders Prize winners, and more. All that coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 463 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI, author, and glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, how are you?
Hey, I'm excellent, and I'm happy to be back. I missed last week because it's my busy season. I just been running like 11, 12-hour days at the airport flying from dawn to dusk, which, you know, someone has to do it, so I shouldn't complain.
Well, speaking of busy, next we have Mr. Busy, also known as Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's also a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody. It's nice to be back after a few weeks of rest. I mean, work that kept me away from the show.
Well, we missed you and you're back, so that's what counts.
That's true. Thank you.
All right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Good afternoon, evening, whatever. Hi, folks. How are you? Looking forward to a good show. It should be pretty explosive.
Ooh, we'll find out what that means in just a moment. But also joining us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. It wasn't me. I wasn't passing gas, so you can't blame any of that on me.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, let's get into our introducing our guest. This episode is Blake Skoll. He's the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. Now, that's a Denver startup. They're looking to build a commercially viable supersonic passenger aircraft. We've talked about Boom. Before founding Boom, Blake held leadership roles at Amazon.com. He was co-founder and CEO of Kima Labs, which was later acquired by Groupon. Blake's an avid pilot. He holds a BS in computer science from Carnegie Mellon University. Blake, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're really looking forward to this. Carnegie Mellon, there's a lot of sharp cookies at Carnegie Mellon. I worked with some of those folks many years ago. They do really, really interesting things there. But flying, what kind of flying have you done?
Well, I've been flying for fun since I was in college. When I was 20, I was interning in the San Francisco Bay Area and realized I lived just a few miles from an airport and thought, gosh, I could go take some flying lessons. And so that kind of kicked off a passion and, you know, spent most of my 20s, you know, flying on and off, finally got my ticket, my private ticket, my instrument rating. But that was kind of my hobby for most of my career while I was doing kind of internet things on the front burner.
Great. Well, because we have sort of limited time with Blake, this episode, we're going to get started right away with our main topic, our conversation with Blake. So are you guys all ready?
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All right, Blake, when we talk about supersonic transports, we know about the limitations that came in, what was that, 1973, when sonic booms over the United States land was prohibited. It's been quite a number of years, but it's kind of all about the boom, right? Managing the sonic boom?
Actually, I would say no. If you look back at the history of history of Supersonic, I think the Sonic Boom concerns really were political fallout from how Concorde came to be and how American aerospace got threatened by it. But the real reason Concorde was, you know, more Thud than Boom was economics. It was built to the best of 1960s technology. A ticket would set you back $20,000 round trip New York to London in today's dollars. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, that's like a bucket list item. It's not transportation. And, you know, Sonic Boom or no, Overland or no, the thing was not efficient enough to actually be mainstream transportation. So that was the biggest problem. And then, can you fly it over land is a whole second question.
So what's changed since then?
Well, we haven't had a speed up literally in half a century. It's amazing. The fastest airplane you can buy from Boeing today is about 50 miles an hour slower than the fastest thing you could buy in the 1960s. So we haven't really changed the capability of airplanes, but we've completely changed how they're built. We've got new materials. We've got carbon fiber composites. We've got turbofan engines that are quieter and more efficient. And we have dramatically improved methods of optimizing aerodynamics that are based on computer simulation rather than wind tunnels. And what surprised me in getting Boom started is that if you run around and you kind of pick up all these innovations that have been built for subsonic in the name of efficiency, instead deploy them in service of speed. I'm talking carbon fiber composites, turbofan engines, new ways of doing aerodynamic development. You put them all together, you can build a new generation supersonic aircraft that's 75% less expensive to operate than Concorde, which means that $20,000 ticket turns into about $5,000 round trip New York to London. And, you know, that's not cheap, but it's about the same as business class. Hmm. And that's a big market. We look at that as kind of a foothold. So if you can hit that market, that's economically very significant. It's going to allow you to go make a bunch of money to invest in further development, and you can do bigger airplanes. You can do more fuel efficient airplanes. You can make them work over land. And I think for the first time, we now have all the pieces to do a supersonic aircraft that's economically viable.
Hmm. Of course, if you have the technology, if you have the business plan, there also has to be demand. Of course, that's part of the business plan.
Yep.
But what do you think the demand is like for supersonic commercial flight?
I haven't met a single traveler who says I wouldn't like to get there in half the time. So I think the passengers want it. When we talk to airlines, airlines are brutally competitive business. We're all flying basically the same airframes, we're in the same airports, the same passenger experience. And then you want to differentiate. Well, in the front cabin, it's like, you know, fly my airline. We got better champagne. I hope you care about that. You know, and in the back, well, you know, we're just keep squeezing legroom and trying to get the price down a little bit. And brand X is not all that different from brand Y. And so these guys struggle to gain market share. They don't grow much. Airlines are growing about 1% faster than GDP because we haven't added any value to travel experience. And so when you go to airlines and you say, hey, would you like to have something different and way better to offer your passengers? Like that, imagine that New York to London flight that's 7 hours today. What if you could do it in 3 hours and 15 minutes? Do you think people would switch airlines for that? They say, you know, holy crap, yes. And so passengers want it. Airlines want it. And it really just comes down to, can you deliver an airplane in an economic package that works for airlines where, you know, they can fly it and operate it in real world conditions and make money? And then for enough passengers, the tickets actually are affordable, not just as a, you know, let me go get my joyride and get my mock ticket. But this is real transportation. It's something you'd use routinely. And I think, you know, today, finally, all that balances, which is why you can, you know, after 50 years, you can finally do it.
Hmm. What do you think about the role of the federal government in all this? We noticed that in the FAA reauthorization bills, I think both the House and the Senate include or ask the FAA to revisit the limitations on supersonic commercial flight that we've seen.
Yeah, well, I'm going to sing the praises of the Senate bill. It's actually pretty different from the House bill.
Hmm.
We've been just really thrilled with the reception that supersonic is getting in DC now. And I think a big part of that is, for a long time, people have assumed that a supersonic renaissance was going to be, you know, for billionaires, to be a private jet, to be a flying gas can with a billionaire at the front of it. And I got no issue with that. But it turns out that I think there are a lot of reasons why it's a better path and certainly more attractive to more people in the public to just do a small airliner instead. And let's make it so that anybody can, you know, buy a ticket and go travel twice the speed of sound. So we've been telling that story and advocating for policies that improve the access and affordability of supersonic transportation. And that's two big things. It's having a little bit of relief on takeoff noise restrictions to treat supersonic as in a different category, and which significantly improves fuel burn, which means the tickets can be more affordable. And then number two, it's repealing the speed limit. Turn it into a common sense noise limit, so you can fly over land and that LA to DC flight that's 6 hours today, maybe that could just be 2.5. Wouldn't that be nice? Hmm. And so the Senate bill, and we've got a huge thank you to Senators Mike Lee and Cory Gardner, who made this happen. Actually, one has both of those. It's got some takeoff noise relief. Says you can build a supersonic airplane so long as it's no louder than what's flying today.
Right.
Which is totally reasonable. No backward step on noise. And then it gives the FAA 3 years to set a noise standard for sonic booms, or it strikes the speed limit out of the law. And so it guarantees some real progress on this. That we'll see not in 10 years, but in the next immediately, and in the next three. The House bill is not as exciting because it creates a committee it's like we'll create a committee and study it, and there'll be a report, and then maybe we'll do something. It's the kind of thing that you look at and you're like, maybe one day my grandkids will benefit from this. So we're telling the story pretty hard of why if you want supersonic to exist and in our lifetimes, and you want to benefit from it personally, we got to move quickly on this. And we're not blocked by not having it, but man, it's going to improve. It's going to make ticket prices lower, and it's going to make it so you can fly it in more places. You're going to get better economies of scale. I don't know what the chances are this makes it into law, but we're pretty excited about it.
Well, Brian found an article in Bloomberg. It's titled "NASA Has a Way to Cut Your Flight Time in Half." And there we see that NASA, and together with Lockheed, I guess, have flown a small-scale model in a wind tunnel just recently, and that NASA is going to take bids coming up this month, August, to construct a 94-foot demonstration model. How does that all fit into this? Are they doing research or creating technologies that will benefit Boom, for example?
Well, the story is more complicated than that. So ostensibly, the thrust of what's going on at NASA is trying to get the overland speed limit repealed and turned into a noise limit. And obviously, if that happened, we'd all uncork the champagne, because we wouldn't suffer those horrifically long transcontinental flights anymore. But there's a lot more nuance to it, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about there's been a belief for a while that supersonic is going to come back with private jets, and when it's a private jet, people get real concerned about this idea of a bunch of billionaires flying over dropping booms and all of this, and so that motivates this technology direction where we got to make this thing ultra freaking quiet. And so NASA has gone and done a bunch of work with Lockheed, and they're like, well, in this small kind of funky airplane that we think we could turn into a business jet, we can make it, we can do a lot of boom cancellation kinds of things. And of course, everyone wants the quietest airplane you can make. The problem is, and this is what doesn't get talked about very much, there's this really interesting trade-off between loudness and efficiency. And efficiency means how much gas do you burn, which means ticket prices, which means emissions, which means CO2, which means like all the bad stuff coming out of the back of the engine, which means range of the airplane. Like there's a real trade-off there. There's certain things you can do to quiet the boom that are aligned with efficiency. And like, basically we're doing all those things. And then if you want more quiet, then you're paying a penalty for it in affordability. And if you look back at, we've done sonic boom testing before. This is not a brand new thing. And there's a lot of evidence, literally from the past half century, that says that Concorde was actually too loud. It was about 105 decibels, and that's not going to break your eardrums, but it's going to startle you. But if you get it down below about 95, and you're not doing it constantly, there's a lot of evidence that says that's okay. It's quieter than other things. We don't live in a perfectly quiet environment. We've got trucks going by, police sirens, your neighbor's weed whacker, and if you get it low enough. There's this kind of interesting sweet spot, which I think is somewhere between 85 and 95, where it both works economically in terms of making tickets affordable to the public, and it's going to be the kind of thing that's it's qualitatively a different sort of sound, but it's no more loud or like disruptive or annoying than other things that we put up with today. And what's really annoying is a long flight. So we're up to, the NASA thing is on this track to. build this demonstrator airplane and they'll fly it in the early 2020s and go collect a bunch of data. Then they'll have some policy proposals in 2025. And no one's going to want to design an airplane to the standard until they know what the standard is. So the design projects will start in like 2025 at the earliest. And maybe like 2035, we'll finally have an airplane that we could go fly on. And, my belief is we got a lot of data on this. We don't need to go spend $300 million of the taxpayer money to go collect more data. And we can go act now and get the benefits of this a lot sooner.
You mentioned a trade-off between fuel consumption and noise level. Can you tell us a little bit about the technology, or what's the physics behind that?
Yeah, so there are actually two things in supersonics that act like that are distinct. And since this is a airplane geeks audience, I'll get to go in more detail this than I usually get to. So one is associated with jet noise, which is basically the sound the engines make, and that mainly impacts the community around an airport. And the second one is sonic boom noise. So I'll talk about each of them individually. So Concorde was the only airplane to ever fly, only passenger airplane to ever fly with an afterburner. And, while we airplane geeks love them because, they're loud, you can't miss them. There's a flame kind of the back of the engine. You fly it at night, it just dropped in gorgeous. If you're an airline, you hate it because, the flame scares passengers. They're not fuel efficient. They burn a lot of gas. And then they're really, really loud. And, it's not like Concorde designers were bozos. They were just working with what they had in the 1960s. And it turns out you don't need an afterburner to go fast. You can do it with a turbofan. But the way you make a turbofan quieter is you go to these higher and higher bypass ratios. Like think of the front of the 787. The engines on that thing have a big fan on the front. Literally, the diameter of that fan is the diameter of our entire airplane. And for subsonic, you go to these big fans. They're quieter and they're more fuel efficient. The problem is those big wide fans are just they're too fat for high speed flight. And the faster you're going, the narrower and skinnier you want everything to be. Supersonic airplanes kind of want to be long and skinny. And so if you go to an abnormally large fan for quiet, you end up taking on a lot more drag and giving up, efficiency, which means, range and affordability and all that stuff. So if you pick kind of a different design point for supersonic and say, hey, there's, we're not going to make this louder than current aircraft, but we're not going to require it to be the same as a latest generation subsonic airplane, then it turns out you can save between 20 and 40% on fuel burn, which is huge. Like airlines get out of bed for 1%. So that's number one. It's really about for subsonic, you can make the fans bigger, and it's quieter and more efficient. For supersonic, you need a narrower engine. And then the second topic is sonic boom, and the way you quiet the sonic boom. So first off, smaller airplanes are quieter, so we get a huge benefit just from building an airplane that's less than half the gross weight of Concorde. But then you start having to do other things to it. You can do these funny shaping with the aircraft where you kind of deform the shape of the body, so some shock waves are canceling out other shock waves, and you're making the whole thing long and skinny so that you're spreading the boom sound over a larger period of time, and that makes it sound quieter. But all those things, either add weight or add drag. And so you start to give up efficiency for it. And, maybe someday somebody will figure out kind of how you do both. Obviously, you want the quietest airplanes you can have. But if you set too stringent a noise limit, then you put efficiency in such a place that this will only work in a private jet kind of model, and it won't be something for the rest of us.
All right. Well, let's talk about boom supersonic in a little more specific detail. So the strategy that we see is the baby boom demonstrator. We've talked about that one before. Followed by, a full-size aircraft. So tell us a little bit about the baby boom and what it's going to accomplish, what its timeline looks like, and so forth.
Let me zoom out a little bit and give you some company context, and I'll come back to those pieces. We're trying to do this thing that honestly nobody's done in 95 years, but to start a new commercial aircraft manufacturer from the ground up. And so obviously that's pretty audacious, and we're also trying to build one that's pretty technically challenging. So you don't rush straight into a certification program. You don't say, hey, great, I'm going to build a Mach 2 170,000-pound airplane. Hope we get it right the first time. you say, well, what can we do sooner with less money that allows us to kind of cut our teeth on this, really, really work the design out, work the technology out, teach the team a whole bunch of lessons, show the world that you actually can do this, and then get us kind of the key design information we need to go off and do a production aircraft. So the idea of the XB-1 Supersonic Demonstrator, or kind of Baby Boom is what we like to call her, is it's as close as we can, a shrunken version of the airliner that shows the key technology, that gets the team design experience and the relevant flight regime. Something we can do with an obtainable amount of money in a short amount of time. So where we stand today, we're about 18 months away from first flight, and we have all the money we need to go build and fly this thing, which is, it's a few tens of millions. It's not, hundreds of millions or billions. And that'll basically prove out all the key technology. It'll show the aerodynamics. It'll show the propulsion flow path. It'll show the materials. And that gives us all the stuff we need to do to go off and then do the production aircraft with a whole lot more confidence that we're going to get it right the first time and not have, infinite slips and overruns and all that kind of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. And the XB-1 demonstrator, that's going to be single pilot size. What are the dimensions of the aircraft?
Yeah, it's about 68 feet long, roughly 20 foot wingspan, and it's actually two pilot. So there's a front seat and back seat. It's tandem cockpit. Huh. We tried to find some. It's a 1/3 scale version of the airliner. We tried to find some 1/3 scale test pilots, and we couldn't find them. So you have to go to a bubble canopy, and it looks a little bit like a fighter jet, but it's a very different mission design than a fighter jet. It's basically all about getting up at altitude and going very fast and very efficiently in a straight line. But boy, it's going to be fun. And yeah, there's a back seat. So, we can, there'll be chances to kind of get a second person get into view.
Will the commercial aircraft be like that as well?
No, it'll be much more like a traditional airline cockpit. We're designing the whole thing such that if you're flying a Boeing or Airbus, wide body aircraft, that it's going to be as easy a transition as possible to fly supersonic. The things that are specific to supersonic flight will as much as possible be handled in software rather than by the pilots. So if you can fly a wide body, you won't need too much of a transition to get into a boom aircraft.
In the XB-1 single engine, is that a GE engine you're using?
No, it's actually a triple engine. So it's tri-jet, just like the production aircraft. And there are GE J85-21 turbojets. Hmm. So relatively old design, originally built for a Mach 2 cruise missile. The particular variant we're using comes out of an F5E.
Okay.
And it turns out it's just the right size class, just the right thrust class. And, again, as much as possible, you want to go learn the lessons for the production airliner in the demonstrator.
In the full-scale plane, what kind of capacity are we looking at for that plane?
Yeah, so we're starting off with a 55-seat aircraft, and which sounds small by today's standards, but the way to think of that is, since we're able to hit a business class kind of price point, I think $5,000 round trip to London, you want to size the airplane so it is like the capacity of business class in a subsonic aircraft. And that way, when you go to an airline, you say, hey, look, if you can fill those seats on your subsonic aircraft today and make money, you can fill them on your supersonic aircraft and make at least as much money. So the intuition is, the more expensive the ticket, the smaller the airplane. And, and ultimately we want to work on more efficiency, get the prices down further, and then build a bigger aircraft. But this is, this is kind of where we're starting. So it's 55 seats. That'll be about 160 feet long. So it's a substantially bigger aircraft, kind of three times bigger than demonstrator.
And again, what's the sort of the forecast if you polish up your crystal ball first flight for the full scale?
Yeah, so the timeline is about 18 months away to demonstrator first flight. So that's, I think, late 2018. Our goal is to get the first pre-production full-scale aircraft in the air by the end of 2020, and that launches a kind of three-year flight test certification program with first deliveries to airlines and first passenger flights in late 2023.
Hmm. I imagine you're talking with some of the airlines, having conversations with them probably about this?
Yes. The interest we've gotten from airlines has actually been surprisingly positive. We announced last year that Virgin is the global launch customer. They've taken the first 10. And we announced last month at the Paris Air Show that we're up to 76 pre-orders now. And that's across five world airlines.
That's pretty impressive, actually, at this stage.
I did not think we'd be that far this soon. But I think what we're really seeing is there's just a hunger for something that's better. I mean, you look at every other area of technology, our phones, computers, communications, medicine, cars, like everything else is getting faster and better. And the airplanes were still puttering around 1960 speeds. And when you show people that you can really do it without any science fiction, without any like unobtainium, that we're just taking bits and pieces we already have and putting them in a different shape, and that the economics really work, there's just tremendous interest in that.
Hmm. I know we're running out of time here, but one thing I wanted to mention that I think is impressive is that when I was on the website, which is boomsupersonic.com, one of the things I always look for is who are these people and you know who's on the team? And when you take a look at that, it's really kind of an interesting group of individuals with a lot of broad experience from Atom Aircraft, from Boeing, Virgin Galactic, Pratt & Whitney. It's an interesting group of people that are assembled to make this happen.
I'm super proud of the team that we've put together for this. The secret of Boom is we've picked a mission that's inspiring enough that you can get the best people on the planet to come help you with it. And that takes something that you might otherwise say, well, that's just a pipe dream. That sounds too hard. And it makes it possible to do, maybe even likely. And so, you know, our chief engineer, this is going to be a seventh aircraft through certification. We got from Pratt & Whitney, the guy who owned the front half of the engine of the Joint Strike Fighter. We got from SpaceX, the guy who owned the entire second stage of the Falcon 9 and invented the thrusters that let him land the first stage. He had 60 people working for him at SpaceX. He quit his SpaceX job to come and own the fuel tank on Baby Boom. And I could go on for half an hour with stories like this. We are able to collect really, really amazing people who have done hard things on other vehicles and bring them together to go do something really important in aircraft. And you can't go hire a supersonic airplane design team off the street. It doesn't exist. The guys who worked on Concorde are either retired or dead. Military is a different world, and they're not scrappy. They don't know how to do anything with a small budget. And so what you do is you go find people like the ones I was talking about who've done hard things in other programs, who've got a lot of breadth of experience, and quick learners, and you give them a chance to go design, build, fly, learn on Baby Boom, and then go off and build the certified aircraft.
Amazing. Well, Brian, do you have one last question?
Oh, I have lots of questions. One is it possible to get two rows of economy seats in this so mere mortals can fly as well? And the other one, I just love the fact on your website that you have all the swag listed. So kudos for getting all that done ahead of time.
Yeah, thanks. So the path towards affordability is really interesting. And this is what gets me super, super excited about this. There's a virtuous cycle. If you look back in history and say, what happens to travel when you shrink flights? You know, it's not just about saving a couple hours here and there. What happens is when you make flights a lot shorter, it's the difference between going and not going. And Max Truscott might relate to this, but you know, before the jet age, a flight from San Francisco to Hawaii was about 16 hours on a flying boat. And so if you're in San Francisco and you thought about going to Hawaii, you learn the flight time, you're like, maybe I'll go to Napa. And so you just don't go. And the first 10 years of the jet age, travel to Hawaii went up 6x. And it kept on going up as we built hotels and resorts and tourist attractions and made it even more interesting a place to go. You took this like exotic kind of unreachable place they wouldn't go to and you made it open to the whole world. And you find that pattern basically wherever you look. When there's a big speed up at a price point a meaningful piece of the market can afford, you go a lot more. And so we're going to build this 55-seater. It's going to be available to anybody who can fly business today. I think what's going to happen is a lot more people are going to go to a lot more places more often. And that 55 seats is going to be way too small. So we're going to build a second airplane that's bigger. And when you build a bigger supersonic airplane, it turns out it's actually easier to make it fuel efficient. You've got less surface area of the airplane per passenger, so your skin friction drag per passenger goes down. And there's some other things you could do with aerodynamics that make it more efficient. And so the bigger airplane is more fuel efficient, which means the ticket prices can come down, which means more people can go to more places more often, which means travel is going to go up, which means you build a bigger airplane, which means you can make it more efficient, which means more people can afford to fly it. And so you get this flywheel spinning. And as that flywheel starts spinning, you know, in our first aircraft, we're deliberately not using any new technology that's not flying on other airplanes, because you got to control your risk. But in second, third generation aircraft, you can start to do things like variable cycle engines. You can start to do more aggressive things with aerodynamics that will also contribute to efficiency. And that when that flywheel gets going, it only takes two or three turns around it before the price points get down to, you know, first premium economy and then more like economy. And our long-term goal in this company is to build high-speed aircraft that are so efficient that you just never decide to go slow. You know, we'll have to take all those subsonic wide bodies and convert them for cargo.
Blake, the one thing you haven't mentioned here, and I want to speak for, you know, Rob and myself, you're clearly going to need a couple of key flight instructors, I would imagine, for this program, right?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Excellent. I don't know if Sign I could go up. That fast, though.
Especially at your age, Rob.
I just like the fact that he knows that he referenced F-5 engines and they actually came from Target drones. That blew my mind. I didn't think many people knew that.
Yeah, we try to know the – sometimes it feels like we're doing technical archaeology. Like you walk in the office any given day and half the engineering team is reading papers on supersonic aircraft design that were written in the 1960s, because that's the last time anybody worked on this stuff.
Blake, I know you've got to go, but just really quickly, are – you going to be doing, is Boom going to be doing the manufacturing and assembly of this, or do you have partners for actually building the plane?
Great question. So for Baby Boom, we're doing all the final assembly ourselves, and we've got some great partners that are helping us out with components and sub-assemblies like Honeywell and GE and Tincati on the carbon fiber side, and the spaceship company, the guys that built the Virgin Galactic spaceships, are building pieces of the fuselage. So we're doing all the final assembly vehicle integration. We got suppliers. You know, for the production aircraft, we're still working out what we're going to do, whether we're going to go standalone and be our own manufacturer or whether we're going to team up. And, you know, both of those options are still on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got some time to decide that. One last question. In terms of staffing, are you all staffed up or is Boom still hiring?
Oh, that's a great question. So if you think this is an exciting mission and you'd like to help, boomsupersonic.com/careers. We're about 35 people today. We have 29 openings that we need to go fill to get this first airplane done. So anything from manufacturing, supply chain to aerodynamics, propulsion, structures, systems. There are lots and lots of opportunities. And we got to just about double the company this year to get this thing in the air.
And are all those jobs in Colorado? Where are they physically located?
Yeah, we're in Colorado. So we're just south of Denver at Centennial, which is a wonderful airport that's flight test friendly. And there have been new airplanes built there and first flown there for about 100 years. That's our headquarters. We're in Hangar 14. If you like to be around airplanes, it's just a really neat place to work. One of the things we believe is you want to have a small, high caliber team and put everybody together in the same place. So you interact in person. Literally the entire engineering team sits in one room. We're going to scale up past that soon. We'll need two rooms. It's a small, tight-knit environment, and the engineering team is around the aircraft as it's built.
Well, it's just great. This is very exciting stuff. Like, it sounds like a dream job. We want to thank you for taking a little bit of your very busy day to speak with us and our audience. I think they're really going to enjoy this conversation. There's obviously a lot of other aspects of this that we could talk about probably for hours and hours, and maybe sometime in the future we'll have an opportunity to do that. So thank you very much.
This is a great fun to have on, so thank you for having me. And if your audience would like to follow along, we're at boomsupersonic.com, or you can follow me at @bscholl, @bscholl on Twitter. And we try to share some behind the scenes stuff as it's happening. So if you're an airplane geek, that's follow us and see the thing as it's coming together.
Great. Thanks again, Blake.
Thank you.
I just want to mention before I forget that Isaac Alexander actually helped us make the connection with Boom Supersonic. He was at their offices, and he actually sent along some photos that we'll have in the show notes that he took from the Boom Supersonic offices. So we really want to thank Isaac for helping put this together. Yeah, yeah. When you look at what he's doing, he's going all over the place these days. It's amazing. I don't know how he makes all these connections, but
and a super nice guy too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, on to the news. Our first story comes from thehill.com. House pushes back must pass aviation bill to September. Well, this, of course, is the FAA reauthorization bills that are before Congress. And David's friend Bill Schuster from Pennsylvania says
No. I'm not taking responsibility for that jackass.
David's buttons are very clear most of the time. But he says that House action on the FAA reauthorization bill will be pushed back to September. We got an email from our listener, Kevin, who sent us some information. He had he subscribes to a morning transportation politics email that comes from Politico, their morning transportation tip sheet. And in that it says, House Transportation Chairman Bill Schuster acknowledged what we had long expected, his FAA reauthorization bill, H.R. 2997, won't get any floor time until September, if ever. Meanwhile, the Senate's FAA bill is just as much in limbo with its controversial changes to the 1,500-hour co-pilot training rule. An extension is all but assured now, folks. That's from Politico. It would be easy to say or to think that, okay, we've got some breathing space here. What happens is the Congress takes August, generally, I guess, off. That's their holiday, and then comes back. And so, Max Trescott, I wouldn't say that we can breathe a sigh of relief that this thing has got pushed off. In fact, maybe just the opposite. Maybe this is the time for those who haven't contacted their congresspeople to reach out.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a real danger that this could suddenly come up quickly for a vote in September or October and get pushed through really, really fast. So, no, I think these things are, you just never know when they're going to rear their ugly heads again. So, and of course, we're talking about extensions. And I forget how many of those we had the last time around where they basically agreed to reauthorize the FAA for, 90 days or 6 months or something like that, basically kicking the can down the road until they get to the point where they can write the full reauthorization bill. So, no, this is this is not dead at all. If anything, it just makes me more leery because it allows more time for the airlines to reach out to their passengers and have those people contact their congressmen, which is why it's so incredibly important that anybody who cares about aviation contact their congresspeople. So, yeah, I would encourage them to do it now.
Yes, and as I think all you know, that many of you listening have contacted your congresspeople and have sent us copies of the responses, which have been very interesting to see. Nathaniel sent in some of the response from some of his representatives. He's from Pennsylvania. Mike Kelly, his response sounds pretty pro-privatization, at least as I read it. His Senator Pat Toomey was kind of uncommitted at this point. Ted sent in his response from his Congressman Ken Calvert, Southern California. Is that this guy's from California, Max T?
Oh boy, we have like 40 some congressmen from California, so I hardly know them all.
Yeah,
So we have some interesting comments. Trevor sent in the response from Arizona, Tom O'Halloran, who he absolutely opposes privatization. He's one of the few congresspeople that have responded to your messages to them saying firmly that he opposes it. Rob, what's going on in your home state? Do you have any indications from your congresspeople?
Well, certainly from our we have two Democratic senators, U.S. senators. Our Dick Durbin's the number three guy seniority wise in the Senate. And, his office responded, as did the junior senator, Tammy Duckworth, and the congressman in our local area, Jan Schakowsky. But what I thought was really interesting is this last weekend when I was up at the airport, somebody that I ran into from west of Chicago mentioned that he had used the EAA link that we had been telling people about and that Max Trescott was talking about on his show. and that his congressman happens to be Peter Roskam out west of Chicago. And what was interesting was his response. And this fellow lives in Peter Roskam's district. Peter Roskam sent him a note back saying, thank you for your note. However, I do not respond to letters that come through associations as group mail. I only respond if you take the time to write me a personal letter. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty gutsy congressman.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that from anyone before.
When I went to that site, when I used that site, which is, Max T, give us the address again.
Sure, G-O-V-T, short for government, govt.eaa.org.
And what it does, if you haven't done it yet, it allows you to put in your location, your zip code or something, and then it shows you who your elected officials are and allows you to send an email to them that's pre-written. And this is what, Rob's describing here. What I did is I deleted most of that pre-populated email and just put it in my own words. And of course, it was much shorter, but it was more personalized. So sometimes I think that can have a greater impact. And, some of you might want to consider that if you take this. It takes more time than just, pressing the send button, basically. But it might be more effective.
I agree with you. I did pretty much the same thing. And, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that a friend of mine sent me that link to the radio ad that the airlines put together in the last few weeks that ran on quite a few, national network stations that basically came from the airlines that said, oh, business aviation, those fat cats pay nothing and just fly around in their cool private jets. And they're the reason that the air traffic control system is such a mess. And I thought, wow, nobody had heard that. In fact, I didn't even know it existed until his friend said it to me. And I thought, wow, those rats at the airlines, boy, they're at it again.
Well, they know
we've got it in the show notes, too. So we'll everybody that wants to hear it can give it a listen.
Great.
And private jets are just the perfect scapegoat. I mean, everybody loves to hate them. Back to the days of the automobile executives flying to Congress, Washington, asking for help, and they all came in their private jets. So, yeah, it's an easy scapegoat.
All right. Well, let's move ahead and look at an item from NBC News. Court rules the FAA must reconsider regulating airline seat size. Now, we talked with Mary Kirby about this in our episode with her. Well, not about the court, but about the seat size, width and pitch and changing and getting smaller. And we talked about the items that are in the FAA reauthorization bills that address seat size. So this is same topic, but coming at it from a different direction. What we see here is that the passenger group Flyers Rights had asked the FAA to write rules that would govern seat space. And the FAA rejected the request. They said, oh, that's a comfort issue, not a safety issue. And so they weren't going to be responsive to that. Well, now we see a three-judge federal appeals court in the Washington district has sided with Flyers Rights. And the court says that the FAA relied on what they called outdated or irrelevant tests in rejecting the request. So the court has ordered the FAA to go back and come back with a better response. Do you guys think that this is going to make a difference in the end?
Well, people don't like anything. And people don't like any kind of a rule that forces a company to do something they don't want to do. And there was an interesting show on Megyn Kelly did a piece Sunday night about the airlines and her on the scene guy, who was a hefty fellow, I should say, did a comparison of the various airlines. And when he got to the Spirit Airline group, which is 20, You guys have to catch me on this. I think it's 28 inches is the pitch. And this guy just barely squeezed into the seat. And I thought about it. And the thing that I really caught my eye was, if I was the guy in the window and this was the guy in the middle seat and we had to get out, I'd have to go over the top of this guy when I watched how difficult it was for him to get out. And, you know, then when this topic came up, when I saw it in the show plan too, I thought, I've got to give FAA credit. I know they must have gone back and done the testing again for emergency evacuation to get people out of these airplanes in the 90 seconds that are required for certification. But I just cannot understand how they could get people out of 28-inch pitch seats quickly. I don't know. I just don't see it.
Is that true? Do you suppose they really have to go back and run that test again? I wonder if they can just...
They would have to. Otherwise, they'd be in,
well, they should,
violating
but...
the sort of...
Well, no, yeah.
Yeah, this is what we talked about.
Yeah, listen to last week's show.
Yeah, this is what we talked about because the FAA or the regulations allow simulations. So that in most cases, if not in almost all cases, the quote retesting is done as a simulation. But there are a lot of conflict. Well, I don't know about a lot, but there are some conflicting studies here. There's even studies out there that say that actually the greater density is safer and aids in emergency evacuations. Right? You say, what's the logic to that? The logic is that with people so close together, there's a greater sense of urgency to get out. And so the evacuation is going to be more efficient. Now, I don't know if I believe that or not, but I think that...
Screw that. I want to get off the airplane as soon as possible.
Yeah, well, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Sounds like a lovely theory, but I'm not buying it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I think that there's, and this is partly what we talked about, but I think there's sort of a lack of real-world testing in these kinds of issues. But the basic thing here, and this is why, you know, the bills in Congress treat this as a safety issue, not a comfort issue, because as a safety issue, they figure it's got a, you know, it's got a chance. Safety being emergency evacuations primarily, I think, but also things like vein clots is something that Flyers' Rights has spoken to as being a safety issue as well. It's coming up a lot, right? We have this court case. We have the FAA reauthorization bills that address these issues. I think we're getting to the point where the flying public is kind of had enough and in one form or another is starting to revolt. But, you know, an issue is, how can you change it? You could really only change it going forward. You can't say, okay, the regulation is now seat pitch minimum, this seat pitch or seat width that, and you're not going to retrofit the entire fleet. That's, you know, that's
why not?
That's billions of dollars. So that will
so
never
what?
Happen. That will never
so
happen.
What?
You think
so
that
what?
Will happen? No, it will
if
never happen.
If it's legislated, it will.
If it gets legislated, it will.
It won't be legislated for that reason. That's my prediction.
Probably.
Well,
but,
then yeah. You wonder, okay, so the FAA, here's what I was thinking about post our discussion last week.
Yeah.
The FAA for safety regulations regulates that aircraft must have blank seat pitch for safety reasons. What authority does the FAA have over Emirates, Qatar, JAL, Qantas? Yeah, they could specify, I mean, all of the foreign carriers, they're not subject to FAA regulations.
If they land here, they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's it. If they want to land in the U.S., you have to follow the certain regulations. But, yeah, it's a complex issue, and, you know, well, you have my prediction. We'll see where this goes. It's going to be good, but... you know, when customers revolt and you're the, you know, the manufacturer, the supplier, the company providing the service, you better be a little careful.
That's why when I booked my flight to Toronto, they, at the end of the tickets, they said, for $10 more, you can get extra leg room. And I'm like, yeah, okay, no problem.
Yeah, for $10? Sure.
And Rob, on Spirit, if you don't want to fly in the knee-crushing 28-inch seat pitch, they have two or two and a half rows of what they refer to as big front seats, where there's a 36 inch seat pitch.
36?
So, yeah. Oh,
smokes. That's almost an emergency exit.
Yeah, that's wow. Pretty comfy.
But, you know, that's very interesting. And of course, the fact that I missed the show last week, I would have known this. But I did not realize that those certifications with the smaller seats or the narrower seat pitch was all done in a simulated fashion. One of these days, some expose kind of TV show is going to grab a cabin on a Spirit-like airplane and try an emergency evacuation and see what happens, I'll bet.
Well, I want to see it on United's 777 with the 10-across seating now, and let's see if everyone can get off that. And again, we talked about having real-world people, right? People with disabilities, people of size.
Old people that
people
move slowly.
Have limited mental capacity. And I would love to see how this works in a real-life simulation.
All right, to be continued, I think. Let's move on to a topic that's completely different and talk about aircraft carriers. First one is from the Daily Press. This is about the USS Gerald R. Ford, which launched and recovered its first fixed-wing flight. And, David, I guess the Ford incorporates some different technologies.
Well, the Ford is a completely new class of aircraft carrier. We're no longer have the Nimitz class. The Ford is a brand new redesigned, lessons learned from the Nimitzes, which are, some of them are almost 40 years old now, aircraft carriers. The two biggest advancements, besides rearranging the flight deck and the superstructure, which got moved back and is smaller than a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, is the AAG, which is the Advanced Arresting Gear System, and EMALS, or the Electromagnetic Launch System. We've moved away from the age of steam arresters and steam catapults. The EMAL system actually uses electromagnetics, a shuttle that the magnetics pulse back and forth as the aircraft moves down and is completely electronic. It's very few moving pieces and takes up less space. It's new technology and it's been challenging. The system's actually set up near me at Lakehurst in New Jersey. They have it set up on the ground, and they were having a lot of troubles getting it calibrated, where you used to just adjust the steam pressure depending upon the weight of the aircraft. This is an electronic measuring system. So if you've been on latest and greatest roller coasters where they shoot you down, it's quieter, it's faster, and this was a big event. It wasn't the first aircraft to land on the deck. Believe it or not, that would have been Marine One and the supporting aircraft for when our president christened it about 3 weeks ago. And the AAG system also is an electronic arrestor system, so you're not using steam catapults for that either. So this was a big deal. It was a VX-23 F-18F out of Patuxent River, did the first takeoff and landing. So it's step for Ford getting up, working towards becoming our latest and greatest supercarrier, which the next one in the class will be the John F. Kennedy, and the third one in the class will be the USS Enterprise, which will launch in 2030. And these carriers will eventually replace the Nimitz carriers. The Nimitz would be the first one to probably retire. Likewise, we just retired Enterprise, which was its own class of aircraft carrier. The Enterprise was different from everybody else. So it's a new step in naval aviation. Ford looks kind of futuristic, and it's going to be kind of cool when it starts launching drones and F-18s and primarily F-35s.
So how does a catapult work? That attaches to the airplane, what, the front landing gear or something?
If you look at the nose gear of a naval aircraft, there's what they call a bar. which drops down and connects into a shuttle. And what the shuttle does is it pulls the aircraft down the flight deck and accelerates it up to speed. So at the end of the deck, the aircraft's flying. With a steam deck, what happens is it's got a giant piston. They build up the steam pressure, and then they release it, and that piston drives that catapult shuttle down the track and takes the aircraft off. Now, it used to be in the original days of steam catapults, they actually had bridles that were roped that would take off, and they'd shoot it down the catapult, and then the bridles would land in a net at the end of it. But the biggest way you can tell is if you look at the naval version or the catapult launch at barrier arrested aircraft, the F-35C, you'll notice that its nose gear is two wheels instead of one. It's a heavier, thicker gear. And then there's that large bar that sits in between the two wheels that they drop into. And that's what pulls the aircraft down the runway or down the flight deck.
Interesting. We have actually a second aircraft carrier. We never talk about aircraft carriers, or very rarely. And here we have another article. This is from, if you can believe it, SaveTheRoyalNavy.org. And I guess this is, they call themselves an independent online campaign to promote the Royal Navy and fight its decline. So I don't know exactly what the issues are there. That might be interesting to look at. But this is titled Up Close with a U.S. Supercarrier and the Pilots Fresh from Combat Operations. And so what we have here is the USS George H.W. Bush. That aircraft carrier is participating, along with the Royal Navy, in an exercise, the Saxon Warrior exercise. And, David, is this a Nimitz class?
Bush is a Nimitz class, named after Bush Sr., and it's participating with the Royal Navy in operations in the northeast waters of the North Sea. Now, H.W. Bush, or the Bush Strike Group, which is Carrier Strike Group 2, is actually returning from fighting ISIS in the Mediterranean. So they're participating in this NATO exercise on the way back to Norfolk in Virginia. But what makes Strike Group 2 interesting is they have a F-18E and a pilot who completed the first air-to-air shootdown since 1999 when an F-16 shot down an aircraft over Yugoslavia. Most of the F-18 attacks are flown as air-to-ground missions supporting U.S. troops and anti-ISIS operations. But we had a Syrian Su-22 that was bombing U.S. troops that were operating with the resistance against ISIS. And this F-18E got the order. And on the 4th of June, we took down our third fitter. The Navy's getting good at taking down Su-22s. Originally, the last time they took down Su-22s was over the Libyan Gulf, where the F-14s took down too. So this is an interesting conversation about the pilot and what was involved, how he got clearance to shoot down the aircraft. He's very it's very modest. It's interesting.
Yeah, he's humble, isn't he?
I love this description he used to describe the shootdown was, all I was doing was delivering my weapons on target. The difference is I'm used to dropping them onto the ground. In this case, it was air to air. And interestingly enough, our latest and greatest missile, the AIM-9X, which is a heat-seeking missile, failed. The decoys for the Su-22 diverted it as a heat-seeking missile. So they used an AIM-120 radar-guided missile to take out the aircraft. So congratulations to VFA-87 and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Tremmel. Let's hope we don't have to do more of that in the future.
All right. Thanks, David. All right, Rob, we have an item here. United Airlines reports second quarter 2017 performance. You've had some dealings with United recently, I understand.
Like an idiot last week, we had my daughter back in Chicago for a family situation that came up, and you know, she was going back to Los Angeles, and I needed a quick flight, and United was a good flight time, and fare seemed decent, and I thought, you know, what does Brian know? He's only flown 80 million miles on United. So I bought the ticket, and I think she was supposed to depart Saturday morning about 10 a.m., and we dropped her at the airport. She went through security and all that, and we said goodbye, and she said, oh, Dad, I'll see you guys later. I'm boarding the airplane. And then about 10:30, she texted us and said, we're still sitting here. Uh-oh. But I thought, oh, come on. The weather's beautiful. I mean, it's United's headquarters at O'Hare, and how bad could it be? Well, to say that they actually didn't depart O'Hare until nearly 4 o'clock that afternoon, I guess I had it coming. And in fact, so of course I took to Twitter, which is just, you know, oodles of fun when this kind of stuff happens. And didn't a couple of the folks that responded on my Twitter feed say something like, didn't Brian Coleman kind of warn you that maybe you wouldn't want to buy any more tickets on United? And I said, yeah, I think he did. And I kind of, it was a, anyway, but what was really funny. So Brian, I got it this time. I got it. I will not spend one more dollar of my money on a United Airlines ticket. Anyway,
but was it a mechanical issue or what happened?
Well, you know, what's interesting is they never actually told the people what the issue was other than saying it was a mechanical. And yeah. So, you know, when I tweeted to United, oh, it must have been, I don't know, it was probably 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So roughly 4 hours after the airplane was supposed to go. And I said, come on, guys, you know, it's 4 hours. Can't you give these people some kind of an update of what's going on? And all that the United Twitter guys would say back was, we're sorry for the inconvenience, but we hope to be back on schedule soon. And so I read that and I went, you got to be kidding me, right? I mean, come on. You know, you've got 100 and some people on this airplane. Well, of course, they did get them off the airplane, at least. I'll give them credit for that. And they had them standing around at the terminal. I said, you mean to tell me you can't come up in 4 hours? You can't come up with something definitive to give to all these people other than, yes, it's a mechanical and we're working on it. And of course, the United people went silent at that point. But that's when all of our Twitter friends started to chime in saying, what did you expect? Come on. Gee whiz.
Is that when they called the Chicago Aviation Department to come assist?
Yeah. I don't know. It was crazy.
Brian, you're on social media even if you don't want to be on social media.
Oh.
Yeah, apparently. I'm kind of excited about that.
Claim your account.
And what's really funny is that the United people reached out the next day and said, oh, we apologize for the inconvenience. Brian knows the wording of this better than I'm sure. And they said, we'd like to offer you something as a token of our appreciation for being a loyal United customer. And I said, these people obviously have no idea who they are talking to. But I thought, okay, let's see what they offered. And they offered a gift certificate.
Ooh, how much?
I think $50.
Oh, what? That's awful.
That's
I was expecting about 200 based on a delay I had back exactly. In January on United. Okay, you agree, huh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything less than 150 is insulting, quite honestly. Yeah. So
was this for Amazon or gift certificate to what? Starbucks? I mean, what do they give you? I know it's for United.
The part is they really didn't explain it, and I thought, I wonder if it's going to come with a name on it, or is it something that I can give to someone that I know that flies United that they can use.
Thank you, Rob.
You're going to frame it. You're going to put it up on the wall.
You know, that's probably, it's probably, I should make a dartboard out of it. But, you know, I guess what I really said, though, too, on Twitter, you know, I said, for crying out loud, you've got these people seated at the gate for hours and hours and hours. You'd have thought that with the record profits that United, somebody at United would have said, look, if we've got an airplane sitting on the ground for a couple hours, let's get somebody from ops or the gate or something to at least go around the gate and see if people want a Starbucks or something. You know, half the people may not even want something, but at least, you know, we'd be looking like we were trying to do. No.
So they didn't even wheel out the ice cream cart?
Well, if they did, my young'un didn't get any, and boy, she'd have gone for that.
Huh. Yeah, I've seen them do that before. Yeah, but chances are, so the certificate, if it's normally what they send, it'll be good for a future United purchase, and it'll expire 1 year from the date that they issue it, but it is transferable to anyone.
So. Oh, that's interesting. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. So, Rob, did your daughter take advantage of the opportunity and just you know, entertain the crowd with some stand-up while they were all waiting around?
Yeah. Actually, what's really funny is that she was showing the Twitter feed to some of the people seated in the gate area, and she goes, "Oh my dad," you know, and they said, "Oh my god, this stuff is hilarious." She called it hilariously sassy. So I think that's a compliment from a comedian, but. I just can't believe how cheap this airline is that, you know, when these kinds of situations, I mean, think about it, what would it have cost them? I mean, and it doesn't happen that often, I bet, but I mean, what would it have cost them to reach out to their customers and say, hey, anybody want a nice cup of coffee or a latte or a cappuccino or, you know, something, and we'll go get it for you. We're sorry. You know, what would that have cost? And think of the grand gesture that the newspapers would have just eaten that up, saying, wow, look at what United did. But they always take the direction of, let's make sure that we don't spend a dime that we don't have to.
Hmm. So that was the perfect comedy setup. How cheap are they? This is where you can respond with the, yeah, whatever joke you have.
Yeah,
it's crazy. But I just thought it was funny that people were pointing out that Brian Coleman was the United expert. So you're getting out there, buddy. Let me tell you.
Wow.
You're going to have to get a stuff. Twitter name pretty soon.
Oh, I have one. I just haven't signed in since the, I don't know, second day of Twitter when I just said, forget it.
All right.
Do you call yourself un-United or?
No, I think, I bet it's alt. Probably, I got it so long ago. It's probably Brian or Brian Coleman. Again, I did it really at the very, very beginning, so getting the name was easy.
Hmm. We'll have to look for it.
So yeah. You're all Oscar Munoz.
Yeah, right, the real Oscar. All right, well, let's talk about Cirrus. Cirrus, you know, you just don't see bad press for Cirrus very often. Max T, what's going on here? Cirrus announces complimentary training program. What's that about?
Yeah, this is really pretty remarkable. The first time I've ever heard of any airline or aircraft manufacturer doing this. Most airplanes, you buy a new airplane, you get training at the factory. Cirrus has gone one step further, and they've just announced last week at Oshkosh that anybody who buys a used Cirrus can get up to 3 days of flight training for free in their airplane, which I think is really remarkable. I interviewed the product manager, Ivy McKeever, in this week's Aviation News Talk about it, just to find out, you know, why did they did it? You know, why do they do it? How are they funding it? And all that kind of stuff. But yeah, basically, they want to make sure that people who are buying a used Cirrus get all the, you know, the same excellent training that people buying a new one would. And I think they believe that it's going to improve the accident rate even better. As it is, over the last 3-4 years, the accident rate on Cirrus has been significantly below that of the rest of other general aviation aircraft. And I think they're just kind of looking at the last little area and going, you know, it seems like, you know, these accidents are disproportionately among people buying used aircraft. So they're trying to, I suspect, target that. But it's pretty spectacular. Anybody who's bought a Cirrus within the last 30 days can sign up and get an instructor. Now, if the instructor is at your home airport, it's no cost to the buyer. If it turns out that you have to, you know, fly an instructor in, then you'll pay for that instructor's airline ticket and, you know, things like that. But otherwise, it's one heck of a deal.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to – you kind of answered the question, but Cirrus contracts out with flight instructors to do this kind of training?
Yeah, so any of us who are Cirrus CSIPs, which are the standardized instructor pilots, so Cirrus standardized instructor pilots can provide the training. So they've got a website to match people up. I've already got the first one that I'm going to do for somebody who bought an SR-20 here locally, and so we'll start doing her 3 days of transition training pretty soon.
Huh, very cool. All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Let's see. Well, I can start. I just have a quickie. This is drone-related, and David knows about this, but I was contacted by Smith College up in Northampton, Massachusetts. They're running they have a summer program for high school students, and one of them is a drone class. And so they asked if I'd come up and talk to the students about the drone industry and some of the observations that David and I would have concerning unmanned aircraft as a result of, what, David, 4 years now producing the UAV Digest? I think our anniversary is in August, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, 200 and the last week was 204.
Yeah, amazing. So that's it for me. Rob, have you got something?
Well, I wanted to mention, I think my now boss, Steve Pope from Flying Magazine on last year, and we were talking about where, you know, aviation writers come from, and they come from all over, and of course, it's people always write back and say, yeah, I know, but where's the chance for me to go out and do anything? And well, something popped up this morning. Paula Williams from ABCI, Aviation Business Consultants. We've had her on the show a couple of times, and they put out a call that said, hey, we're looking for new aviation writers. And so we'll put a link to the invite in the show notes, but I just thought it was interesting that they said, you know, no experience necessary. They'll give people an assignment, see how they do, and the ones that they like, they're going to try and hire.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, what a great opportunity for people that say, boy, I really wish I could be an aviation writer. I mean, let's be serious. If I can do it, they can hire anybody. Come on, let's be serious.
You're too modest, Rob.
Yeah, and I just thought it was a great opportunity. So I wanted to mention it to people. And again, we'll put the, if they go up to the ABCI website, which you'd think I remember the URL from right off the top of my head, but I don't. But we'll put the link in the notes, and people that are interested can go click on that and check out that for some additional information.
Cool. All right. Who else? Brian, anything remarkable aviation related?
I mean, other than his status as a United Airlines information guru.
Such a reputation.
Or the fact that he's on mute.
Yeah. I was really grateful for Rob to stall so I could find the unmute button. No, so I've been home all week, and this week I will be still grounded, except for Thursday. I'm doing a day trip up to San Francisco. So flying up in the morning, flying back at night. So sorry, Max West, I won't be able to get to see you. And I'm really hoping one of these days I'll be able to get together with Fred Sampson as well and go flying with him. But I need a little bit more than 8 hours on the ground in order to get this accomplished.
All right. Max West, something about tires that weren't round?
Yeah. So about 10 days ago, I successfully helped close the main runway at Stockton Airport for about 2 hours, which is noteworthy because that's the only runway that they can land airliners on. And there was one coming in from Allegiant in about 2.5 hours. So it was rather interesting. I was doing transition training with a gentleman into a Cirrus SR-22, and he'd previously flown with another instructor, and he kind of put something that person said together with something that I said and came up with an incorrect solution. So when we were doing a short field landing And after a short field landing, you're supposed to brake firmly. And I wanted him to progressively push a little harder on the brakes, but he had heard from this other instructor that you should never hold them continuously, so he was pulsing them, which is just the worst possible thing you can do on the small GE aircraft. I didn't even notice he was pulsing. I couldn't feel the difference, but the trouble with pulsing is that if you get harder, then eventually you're going to lock a wheel and skid a huge hole in the bottom of the tire, which is what we did. So I kind of saw the aircraft start to, head off the center line. I thought, oh no, flat tire. At that point, I hadn't realized that that he had, flat skidded it, complete hole in the bottom of it. But we got really lucky. I don't know if I mentioned probably a year and a half ago, I was in Colorado where we got a flat tire on the runway, and the crew there damaged the aircraft in the process of trying to get it off the runway. So I was really vigilant to make sure that this crew used the right methods and tools. And fortunately, there was an FBO that had already sent their people home, but they were already able to call a mechanic in about 25 minutes. And they had the proper jack to jack up the airplane. And then they had a little four-wheel dolly to slip under the now dead wheel, and then towed the whole thing slowly off. So it was I'm just happy it wasn't one of those 100 degree days at Stockton, but it was probably in the upper 80s or 90, and we were standing on the tarmac of this 8,000 or 9,000 foot runway for 2 hours. So it's the experience turned out well, but it's never where you want to be.
Wow. All right, David, have you been playing around at a small airfield in Pennsylvania?
Well, yeah, I have a new camera, and I went up to Wings Field. Max knows where this is because we've been there for a car and airplane show. And
yeah,
they happened to be a SR-20 doing touch and goes and taxiing up. So to help illustrate Max's two stories, I decided to use one of the pictures from my new Nikon. The other thing I want to say is I booked my tickets to Toronto. I arrive September 27th, and I'm up there visiting my family until October 1st. But I'll be attending the big drone show on behalf of UAV Digest. But if any of our listeners up there want to meet for dinner or cocktails or something, I sound like Brian Coleman. I'll be up in Toronto those days, so give me a shout out.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about the big drone show, there's a link to it over at the UAVDigest.com over there on the right-hand side. Scroll down a little bit where we have a couple of conferences and things like that related to unmanned aircraft and drones, and you'll find that in there if you want to learn more about that one. All right, we have a shout-out. This is actually a great big shout-out, and this is kind of breaking news. This came out today. The Aviation Geek Fest in Seattle for 2017 has just been announced. David Parker Brown announced it on Airline Reporter. We'll have a link to that. He says that the International Aviation Geek Fest 2017, the most important event for commercial aviation fans from around the world, is set for September 29th, 30th, and October 1st at the Future of Flight Aviation Center and Boeing Tour at Payne Field. This is something that I attended last year. It's kind of like a mecca for av geeks, as is Oshkosh and a few other events like that. If you're interested in joining, you need to go to our show notes at airplanegeeks.com/463, and you'll see a link to this article. It tells you where you can get on the email list. What happened last year, I assume it's going to be similar this year, is they set up a system where you can basically put yourself in line or in the hopper, let's say, for tickets. And then I think they're randomly drawn out. Now, that's how they did it last year. They'll probably do something similar. It worked very well last year. Only 250 roughly people can be accommodated, and that goes really, really fast. So if you're interested in attending this, you want to get your information straight, get in there so that you have a shot at it. It's also a great thing to do with your kids too. Highly recommended.
And Max, it only worked out great because we actually got selected.
Yes, that's right. David, Brian, that's right. Brian went as well. That's right. We both attended last year. That was like one of the high points of not just 2016, but...
Yeah, the decade.
The decade. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, I so want to go back to that. Unfortunately, I can't this year. And I think my chances of getting selected again are slim, as they want to, of course, allow more people to experience it. Yeah. But I would sign up for that again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you get to see things, behind the curtain in Boeing. You get to see things that even if you take the normal Boeing factory tour, you don't get to see. Again, I don't have any details. I don't think there are details yet as to exactly what the events are going to be, but you can bet they're going to be good. Moving on to listener mail. We heard from Utah Patrick. This is, I love this thing. David, you can help us with this. This is an article, Tesla Model S, and everybody knows what a Tesla is, right? The electric car. Is being used as a chase car to launch spy planes at Royal Air Force Base. That's exactly what it is. They're U-2 spy planes. And, David, they're accompanied by a chase car. And they're using in this case, they're using the Tesla Model S. Why do U-2s need a chase car?
They don't like to land, and they're very hard to see when you are landing. The U-2 is a bicycle aircraft, and what happens is there's very poor visibility downwards in a U-2, and it's a large aircraft it's a glider with a jet engine, and it doesn't like to land. So what happens is as the U-2 crosses the final threshold, normally at Beale, what happens is they pull out one of their Z-28s and they gun it with a radio, and they talk the U-2 to the ground. You're 20 feet, 30 feet, 10, until you are on the ground. It also gets it out to the aircraft quicker because the U-2 is got a single nose wheel and a smaller pair of wheels on the center line for weight. And the wings are so big, they have something called pogos, which are little wheels, like bicycle training wheels, that plug into the outside of the wings so you don't damage the tips of the wings. So you need to go at least 155 miles an hour to stay behind the U-2 to talk it in. And usually, it's always been one of my dreams is I want to be the chase car in a U-2. The Tesla evidently is even more optimized because the Tesla with the electric is very smooth and very quick to accelerate. That's why you're always using sports cars. They used to use Corvettes and Z28s, and they've used Ford Mustangs over the years. Whatever the fastest car they could get to be able to, with decent visibility, so that they could talk a U-2 down. And they've been doing this for a long time. So... it's kind of cool. I don't see them going out and buying a bunch of Teslas. I don't see the Pentagon doing that, but it's a good test, and it's good publicity for the Tesla organization.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, electric motors generate huge gobs of torque really right from the beginning, as opposed to an internal combustion engine, which is it's got a torque curve, but the torque climbs over relatively short period of time. But an electric motor, man, when you put the current to that, you've got like instant torque. And so they'll accelerate very, very quickly. So thanks to Patrick for sending that in. There's a video associated with this. So take a look at the show notes and you'll see that. We heard from our friend Jonathan Barron, past guest, Mr. Shark Arrow, and he has some really great news. We've talked about the EAA Founders Prize, an annual event, and it turns out that the winning team of high school students included Jonathan's son, Thomas, and along with Justin and Max, another Max, yay. They're from Alexandria, Virginia, and they won first prize. This is an Airbus-sponsored competition, and their concept was the Remora system. That's what they call it, the Remora system. And It focuses on displaying airspeed and angle of attack on a head-mounted display. Very interesting. They've been working on this for a while. There were some other prizes. Second place went to Andy Mayer. He had a concept, the aural cueing system. It's a small box, can be mounted anywhere in the aircraft, and it provides progressive aural cues as the aircraft approaches altitude regimes where loss of control may be imminent. Third place went to actually a former astronaut, Mike Foll. Solar pilot guard was his idea. And this is a device that attaches to the aircraft wing, and it feeds differential pressure measurements to a neural network processor. And that's a very interesting interesting concept. The idea is that it detects the potential for loss of control. Fourth place was Ethan Brodsky, the Buzzball, and they get my choice for best title, the Buzzball. So it's a sensor in a processor package, and it generates haptic feedback or buzzing through the pilot seat. And it says reflecting when the aircraft is in an uncoordinated state. By indicating on the left side or right side of the seat, the pilot can immediately make corrections that keep the turn coordinator, quote, ball centered at all times. So very interesting. I'll have a link in the show notes to this. And we're going to see if we can get this team, Thomas Barron and Justin and Max, on the show in the future, and they can tell us the whole story behind their idea and the competition. So very exciting news. Very exciting.
Yeah, we had the guy on last year. Yeah, we had the winner on last year.
Yes, we did. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that was Ehab, who's a software developer at Google. And it is, to me, it's kind of remarkable. Last year it was somebody who has been out there for years working in industry. This year, high school kids. I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
It really is. That's very cool. Yes. And then time for one last email. This came from Brett, who was at Oshkosh. And a few comments. He said, Cirrus had a beautiful setup this year. Their planes look great. Icon had a prototype of their boat-type trailer to pull the plane behind your car or truck. He said, this plane can be put in the water like a boat. He also mentions the memorial to Bob Hoover at the end of Monday's air show was very nice. And at the end, after the four planes, one of each type that Bob Hoover had flown, he said it seemed that the P-51 didn't want to land as he just kept flying back and forth down the 1836 runway doing loops and rolls. So terrific. Of course, Oshkosh is just ending as we record this, or has ended just as we record this. And next week, we're planning to have our good friend Steve Vischer, that you, of course, will know from Plane Crazy Down Under, on the show. He was at Oshkosh, so he'll be able to tell us some about the show. He's also in the United States for a short period of time, and so we're planning on having him on as our guest. If you were at Oshkosh and would like to give us some feedback, tell us what your favorite moments were, or some high points or even low points if you had some. Talk about the people you met. Send them along to us, the geeks at airplanegeeks.com, and we'll kind of see if we can make kind of a little compendium of reflections on Oshkosh. All right. With that, any closing comments from the gallery here?
You mean the peanut gallery?
I almost said peanut gallery, but I thought that would be, not so kind.
No, you're right. I'm glad we didn't say that.
Okay. Wait a minute. That's what we're paid here on this show, right?
That's right. Peanuts.
It'd be an insult to peanuts.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Rob, we hear that it's August. It's the first day of August as we're recording. No, it's not August yet. It's the day before.
And you can hear the cicadas in the background?
And we can hear them. Yeah. Yeah, it's the Chicago cicadas from August. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so if you're listening and wondering what the kind of odd noise is from time to time, that's our annual August cicadas from Chicago.
It's a cicada grab here in Chicago.
That's right. All right. With that, we'll bring this episode to a close. We want to thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Our guest was Blake Scholl, the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. It was a great conversation. We really look forward to having him on the show again and getting into some more aspects of supersonic flight. Perhaps as that program develops, we'll be able to get him on again. Very interesting topic. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/463. Go to our website if you'd like to find out where you can, well, find us on social media, how to subscribe, how to contact us. It's all on the webpage, airplanegeeks.com. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Let's see, Max Trescott, let's start with you.
Oh, let's see. Go out to aviationnewstalk.com, or I've got a new Instagram account. Again, just look for Aviation News Talk.
Great. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, anything that has jet wine in the name of it. And, of course, flyingmag.com or inside the pages. Actually, I have to rephrase that. I'm not really inside the pages. The words that I write are inside the page. So I just wanted to clear that up.
I thought you were that movie. Remember The Thin Man?
Yes, that's true. I guess I could be the flat man.
What was that piece you wrote recently? Was it Aunt Edna? What was that?
Oh, gosh. Well, that was a piece about the other time that the airlines took business aviation to task. They had a lady dress up as a kind of a Mrs. Doubtfire kind of person talking about those big wigs in their business jets just scooting ahead of all of us in the line at the airport that are paying good money to fly on the airlines. It's kind of like this radio ad that we put in the show notes tonight. It's, you know, the general aviation folks are responsible for everything bad in your life as an airline passenger.
Yeah, it was a good article. I enjoyed it. All right, let's see. Who else? Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, since I'm still not being social, I'd appreciate people sending me an email when I do get mentioned in social media to Brian at airplanegeeks.com.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter sometimes at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Oh, also, David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
I was waiting for that.
Sorry, I got to the UAV Digest part and then it struck me. All right, David, where do we find you online?
You can find me on my Instagram account at David_Vanderhoof, or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or What Just Flew By, and of course on Friday mornings with that guy who forgets my name, Max Flight, on the UAVDigest.com.
Sorry, David. And besides that, you can also find me at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions. He takes aviation sounds and combines them with other music. Find that at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Hey, see you next time.
And thanks for listening.